So maybe just catch you
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. If those of you who haven't taken a seat would like to, is this mic on? Can you hear me at the back? Excellent. My name is Andrew Harrop. I'm the General Secretary of the Fabian Society. It's a pleasure to organise today's event. This is the first of three events in different parts of England and Wales, looking at what we've called the people's case. So the question for the event today and the other two, which will take place in Manchester and Brighton, is there a people's case for Europe? And what we mean by that is that there's so much debate already about the business case. Does big business, does the economy at large benefit from being in Europe or not? We wanted to take this from the boardroom table to the kitchen table and ask, what does Europe mean for typical families up and down the country, in Wales, in all parts of England, in Scotland and Northern Ireland, with a particular focus, given our interest as an organisation of the left, on low and middle income families. So I think we are aware that there are tangible benefits to Europe if you are a highly mobile, affluent family. But what about typical families with relatively modest incomes? Do they benefit from Europe or not? And in due course, how would people like that decide to vote? So that's the exam question of this series of events. We're delighted to be working with the European Commission in the representation in the UK, who have very generously supported the organisation of these events. And today's event is also organised in conjunction with the Welsh Fabians, which, if you're not involved with the Welsh Fabians and the Fabian Society already, we'd strongly encourage you to speak to colleagues at the back and find out about joining. As you'll see from the agenda, we have three sessions which will be basically running back to back with very short turnovers between them. And I've the pleasure of chairing the first session, which is titled From Boardroom Table to Kitchen Table, Is There a People's Case for Europe? We'll be hearing from Nia Griffith, the Shadow Secretary of State for Wales, first of all. She will give us an opening speech. And then we'll have short contributions from Kelvin Hopkins MP, who is a prominent figure in the Labour Leave campaign. Then we'll be hearing from David Ellis-Thomas AM from Plaid Cymru, and then we'll be hearing from Stuart O'Dally, who is a member of, and I'm going to get you wrong, Wales Stronger in Europe, which is part of Britain Stronger in Europe. I've got that right, haven't I? And David will be speaking in Welsh, so you have translation in front of you when that moment comes. So I think that's everything in terms of introductions, except to say that we have some students from Cardiff University who are filming. If you don't want to be filmed, just let them know at the end and they'll make sure that you don't appear. And there's also an audio recording. And with all the housekeeping out of the way, it gives me great pleasure to kick off the event by welcoming Nia Griffith. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much indeed. I've got to apologise, first of all, because my voice isn't up to its usual capacity, and therefore I'm not going to be able to be quite as dramatic as I would like to be. I've got to be a little bit restrained. I see you're putting a clock in front of me. Is that to keep an eye on me? Oh, if somebody had a timer, that would be a good idea, wouldn't it? Otherwise, you don't know. Never let politicians go on. You don't know what might happen. Right, so first of all, I'd just like to really try to bring home really some of the main points that I think are really important about why it matters for families here in Wales that we should stay in the European Union. I'd like to thank Andrew first of all and the team for the hard work in putting things together this afternoon, and for everybody for braving the weather to get here. Now often I think the debate about the EU tends to be conducting perhaps a very distant sort of language, perhaps not the language which relates to everyday people and everyday lives, and I think we're going to try to overcome that barrier a bit this afternoon. So let's have a look first of all. One of the most important things for our communities here in Wales are obviously job opportunities, chances for people to get on the ladder, chances for people to get education and training. And we do know that we have a large number of companies here in Wales who are investing here because we are part of the European Union. I can name you in my own town companies which have sister companies somewhere else. We've just seen new lines put in one of my car factories. And I just know that if we were not going to be remaining in the EU, there would be very serious question marks because that family has factories elsewhere. And we have the same with other factories. They actually have sites that they can move things to. So I think it's a really important issue, certainly for many of our workforce, where for the first time in many years, we're actually seeing a little bit of an increase in some of the car component factories in terms of people they're taking on. So it's not just theoretical to say that the EU supports over 200,000 jobs in Wales and is the most important export market for many of our companies. It's actually a reality for many families and the family next door and the corner shop who depends on all the families who work in the factory. Anybody running a business, of course, in Wales, they're very dependent on those people who are also part of companies which are exporting to Europe. So even if your company isn't or your little shop isn't, you might be providing the transport, you might be providing supplies, you might be part of the long chain of component parts, you might be part of the service industry that benefits from people having jobs that do depend on Europe. But of course it's not just trade. We here in Wales are a net beneficiary of EU funding. We are very lucky in that we receive more than we put. We receive more out than we put in, and many of those schemes that are run by the Welsh Labour Government are in fact also supported by funds from the EU. We have Jobs Growth Wales, which is built on the model of the Future Jobs Fund that many of you will be familiar with from the last Labour UK government. And it's arguably the most successful jobs creation scheme in Europe. It has focused in its latest phase on the private sector as opposed to the public sector. And the Welsh Labour Government programmes helped over 15,000 young people into good quality employment since 2012. And it is supported by EU funds. Now, some £25 million of European funding has been agreed to support the continuation of the scheme over the next 3 years. This investment will support the creation of thousands of new job opportunities for 16 to 24-year-olds, and the aim is to create 2,900 of these jobs by the end of March this year. Now, in total, EU-funded projects have already helped over 196,000 people to gain qualifications and nearly 64,000 people into work. This isn't about handouts from Europe, it's about vital partnership between the EU and the Welsh Government. Last year we announced the creation of over 52,000 apprenticeships in West Wales and the Valleys over the next 4 years, with the majority of places targeted at 16 to 24-year-olds would be possible because of EU funding, matched by Welsh Government funding. Welsh universities also benefit from the EU's Horizon 2020 project, which provides funding for research and innovation focused on improving Europe's competitiveness. And I think it's recently been shown in the press that UK universities as a whole do actually benefit very considerably and draw more than their weight, if you like, from the funds available for universities. But also EU investment plays a vital role in guaranteeing the infrastructure projects that will make Wales a more attractive place to locate businesses and invest in. Again, this is only because we are part of the EU. Examples include upgrading of the Heads in the Valleys Road, again a joint project between Welsh Government and the EU, which will be a major boost to the local economy and help regenerate the valleys. Likewise, regeneration programme in Swansea and many other parts of Wales. In fact, some total of 290 projects received a total of £2 billion of EU structural funds between 2007 and 2013. And I think we can be very certain that whilst the EU has very strict criteria for which areas will qualify for the help that they give, and we have that difficulty of being a geographically distant area from the main markets, we qualify. I don't think there's any way that we would see a scrap of this money coming to our area or any other of the areas under disadvantage if it were up to the current UK government and their likes. I think we would not see a penny of it. So, where would that leave us? Well, I think for your average family, if you just think about it, you know, chap coming home from work and he comes home and he says, Mum, says they are taking that new line, you know, they're going to have it taken to Spain. Not many jobs for us temps anymore. And his sister Kylie says, and what about my apprenticeship? Well, I think you can forget that. I don't think there's going to be any more apprenticeships in this company now. Not with the EU funds gone. And of course, not like in my day when we had Jobs Growth Wales and I could go on a scheme with them. There's not going to be anything like that. Well, says Mum, you better get going down to Cardiff. Well, we might if they had actually managed to extend the railway up here. But up in Uppercombe, there's not much hope for that, I don't think. Not now that project was abandoned. So I think we can see that it's everyday lives. It really is people's jobs. It really is people's job opportunities. It really is about opening up the areas of economic disadvantage. And I do feel that we will be putting all that at risk if we come out of the EU. Of course, red tape, that's a favourite, isn't it? That's an absolute favourite with the people who moan and groan about the EU. But the whole point of the EU is actually to streamline, make it much easier for countries to work together. Otherwise, we'd each have to have our own standards. But there's another aspect of red tape which is extremely important to us on the left, and that is the confusion of the word red tape with rights. And for us, those employment rights, like the four-week paid holiday, like the same sort of rights for people who are part-time workers as for full-time workers, those types of fundamental rights are something which are EU-wide, and you can understand the right wanting to pull out because they could scrap the lot. That is their agenda. And there's no point, you know, not telling people that. I think people should know that they've got this trade union bill going through Parliament now, and that would only be the beginning if they had their way and were able to tear up just about anything they could. We know sometimes they're controversial, but at the end of the day, things like the Working Time Directive are about protecting not just the workers, but the people they serve. They're about safety for all of us. So, I mean, all of these parts of the social chapter or social charter are of immense importance, I think, to us, particularly those of us who want to stand up for people who need to be stood up for, if you like, who have rights that are being torn up day after day by the ultra-right. So, I think now turning to the thorny issue of migration, I don't think this is going to be an easy topic for us, so I think it's something we do need to talk about, particularly for those communities, some here in Wales, who've been very, very much, I think, affected by recent migration because they weren't part of the greater migrations of previous decades. So, for example, whether it's been, you know, carrots that have needed to be picked in East Anglia or whether it's sheep that have needed to be slaughtered in West Wales, there have been jobs that have needed to be done and people have come in, and it has been something perhaps that we haven't entirely managed as well as we might have done. Perhaps we haven't taken on board some of the fears that people have had. Perhaps we haven't really addressed some of the questions that they've asked. So, very difficult. If you look back to 2004, you can be, you know, wise in retrospect. Why did we not have a seven-year transition period for the new countries from Eastern Europe coming across? But quite frankly, because we had industries crying out for more labour. So yes, we were the only country along with Sweden and Ireland who didn't have that seven-year transition. We then decided we would for the Romania and Bulgaria populations that were joining. And so, you know, we undertook to have a seven-year transition. Then we made that decision in 2006. And so when in 2014 that actually came to an end, we didn't have a massive rush. I think if you remember, that the numbers were actually lower than anticipated of Bulgarians and Romanians coming when the end of that transition period was over. So there's an awful lot which is myth up in the air about migration, and sadly the whole issue of the refugee crisis with Syria has been conflated into the same issue for many people. But it's actually by being in Europe and working with our European partners that we can look at the issues of climate change, war, and economic differences, which are the pushing factors for many people from outside the European Union for actually coming to the European Union. And we need to tackle that as a sensible European Union, not by thinking that the way forward is just simply for us to up sticks and somehow close the doors. It just wouldn't work, would it? How would our health service work if we didn't have somebody to come and staff it? You know, we can't just think that just because we're not part of Europe, we won't need some migrant labour. We have a very rich country. We have many problems of how that wealth is distributed, but by world-class standards, we're a rich country and therefore we're likely to suck in people from other countries to be part of our economy. I mean, that's how the, you know, the world works. And I think it's very, very, you know, it's something we've really got to decide how we're going to frame this argument, how we're going to talk to people, how we're going to accept that the EU is not the deciding factor when it comes to migration. I think there's this great belief that suddenly, you know, nobody will come here. And of course, we've also got to counteract the idea that nobody coming here is actually feasible or a good thing, because it isn't going to work for us. So I think there's a real question mark for us over how we tackle the whole issue of migration. I think it's something that we do need to talk about. But anyway, to sum up, where are we? Well, I think the important thing for me about what David Cameron's done, it's not what he achieves or what he doesn't achieve in this negotiation. It is more the fact that you can negotiate. I don't for one minute think that there's any institution which you don't want to change in some way. We want to change all our institutions in some ways. We want to make them work better. And that's absolutely the same with the EU. And I don't see the EU as a sort of brick wall of bureaucrats or something like that. I've been on the European Scrutiny Committee, as has Kelvin, and we've met MEPs from other countries. We've also met MPs from other countries, and they all have to respond to their public, their democratically elected representatives. And there's very much a mood across the whole of Europe that things can be done in different ways, that we do need to move forward for the 21st century, that maybe some of the, inverted commas, ever closer union, as it's sometimes referred to, is not perhaps the way forward, that there are things we do want to make sure are easier done because they're done together, but there are also some things which perhaps individual countries will want to do differently. So there's a mood there which says, you know, there is opportunity for change, there is opportunity for negotiation, and I really, really think the important thing is that we're part of it. What I find so frustrating with the whole Cameron approach, I really don't think it's about what's for the best for the British people. It's more about him getting some glory. If he really wanted certain changes, why wasn't he there back in 2010, actually, instead of playing silly games, to-ing and fro-ing, but actually negotiating the change then? And I honestly do not know whether it was a genuine oversight or somebody deliberately messing up, but the idea of setting 2017 as a deadline for this referendum, when it's the very year in which the UK is going to hold the presidency. And for anybody who's not aware, the presidency is a six-month time when, obviously, most countries who take the presidency try to make some sort of impact, try to stamp their mark on Europe. But there's a six-month period leading up to it when you're working in tandem with the outgoing presidency, and a six-month period afterwards when you're working with the incoming presidency. And to put that, to have the idea of a referendum being sometime in 2017, therefore obviously right in the middle of this run-up to the UK presidency, I just don't know who came up with the idea. So, as I say, I do wonder whether it was a big mistake, and of course that's what set the panic now about trying to get it done this year, because quite clearly letting it run into a presidency year would hardly look good that the country who's actually the incoming presidency country was actually having a referendum about whether to even be part of the EU. I mean, you know, it's so farcical you can't make it up, but can you really? Anyway, on that note, I think there is a real mood across the whole of the EU, a mood that wants to work together, a mood that wants cooperation, a mood that recognises the UK's position in the world. We are still extremely influential within the EU, and I think we will remain more influential in the world, in the UN, for example, if we have an influential position in the EU. And there is a mood, I think, to work with us and to do things with us. And so although there may be things which we don't like, things we feel are difficult, things we feel need to be talked about, there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that for all of the reasons that I've mentioned, the economic reasons and the social justice reasons, we should firmly stay in the EU. Thank you.
Mia, thank you very much for a very thoughtful set of contributions. Perhaps your inability to be your passionate self brought over a sort of a contemplative tone, which is really appreciated for this debate, because it is about head as well as heart. Now, I'm very pleased to welcome our next speaker. Kelvin Hopkins MP made the trip today from Luton, who is going to be reflecting on, if you like, the other side of the argument, as one of the main proponents of Labour Leave. So, Kelvin, could you tell us, if you like, why you don't think there is a people's case for Europe for low and middle income families?
Well, thank you very much indeed. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation. I should say that I'm talking not about Europe, but about the European Union, which are two different things. I love Europe passionately, but I do not love the European Union, which I think is a political construct. I love Britain, but not the Tory government, should we say, as well. I've only got 4 minutes, so I hope you'll excuse me if I read my speech. I do have a heavy cold as well, but it won't stop me, I hope. The European Union is anti-democratic, anti-socialist, and failing economically. Historically, it has been the left who have opposed the EU and its previous incarnations. Labour, led by Hugh Gaitskell, opposed British membership of the common market, and Nye Bevan and Clement Attlee in his last years were similarly opposed. The left believed then, many of us do now, that the project is essentially laissez-faire capitalist, designed by degrees to dismantle the post-war world of democratic socialism and social democracy established as a democratic answer to communism. The EU is about shifting economic power away from democratic governments and parliaments, and handing that power to markets, to private companies, and thus to global corporate capitalism. It is a subset of global neoliberalism. The EU's behaviour towards Greece and other troubled economies has been brutal, with savage austerity and public spending cuts demanded as conditions of bailouts. Greece has 25% unemployment, has seen output and living standards cut by a quarter, with forced fire sales of public assets in an orgy of privatisation. Other EU countries have had similar experiences. The clincher has been the EU's secretive negotiations with the global corporations to impose TTIP on us all, giving powers to the corporations to sue democratic governments for loss of profits, past and future, from privatisations. I want to see the UK free to manage and determine its own economic future. An exit will enable that. I hope too that other EU countries will follow Britain's example in a renaissance of democracy across the subcontinent. Britain will immediately benefit from not having to make a net annual contribution, an enormous contribution, of at least £14 billion, some say £19 billion, to the EU budget. We will be free of the CAP and save on food. We will be able to subsidise agriculture, our regions and our industries as we choose. We will not be prevented from using state aid to revive our ailing manufacturing sector and from using public procurement to do the same. We will be able to withdraw from the common fisheries policy, which is absolutely crazy, and restore fish stocks and our fishing industry. Above all, we will be free to make our own laws and be governed by them, and to remove governments at elections if we don't like them. I believe that millions of British people feel the same and will vote to leave on June 23rd. There is a burgeoning of left opposition in other EU nations, with left parties eating into previous support for the traditional left of centre parties. PASOK in Greece has been destroyed by Syriza. Left Eurosceptic parties have grown rapidly and found electoral success in Portugal and Spain. And the EU nomenclatura are increasingly nervous about the future of their project. But even 10 years ago, it was the left, the working class and trade unionists, who defeated plans for an EU constitution in referendums held in France and Holland. We in the Labour Party should be looking to our voters and potentially suspend millions of people who...
We're not trying to gag you, let's hold off.
I've only got two sentences more.
You go on, Calvin, we'll be told by the officials.
Yes. We should be looking to our voters, of whom there are potentially millions who oppose the EU. I speak for them in Parliament, and I think others should do so too. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll assume it's safe to carry on, unless I get nodded at from the back of the room. And so I'm delighted to welcome Daphne Ellis Thomas AM to give a Plaid Cymru perspective.
Well, I'm not sure if you can apply coming perspective from me, but I will hope as well. Mae'n bleser gen i gael anerch yma heddiw o safbwynt Cymro Dwyieithog Ewropeaidd sydd yn cynrychioli poblogaeth sydd yn nes at Iwerddon nag y maen nhw at Gaerdydd nag at Lundain. Poblogaeth sydd yn ddibynnol ar bysgodfeydd, ar dwristiaeth, ar amaethyddiaeth ac yn arbennig, wrth gwrs, ar ynni. Ac y mae datblygiad ynni yn fater o bwys enfawr i ni yng Nghymru ac yn y Deyrnas Unedig. Mae Cymru yn draddodiadol yn ardal sydd wedi bod yn cynhyrchu ynni ar gyfer gweddill y byd. Ac yn fwy diweddar, da ni wedi bod yn gwneud hynny gyda ynni niwclear, sydd yn ynni carbon isel, rhag ofnbwr hynny chi ddim yn cofio hynny, a hefyd ynni heidro, lle rydyn ni'n defnyddio yr adnoddau hynny. Ond bellach, y mae Gogledd Cymru, yr ardal ydw i yn byw ac yn gweithio ni, yn cynrychioli ynni gwynt a raddfa enfawr. Ac y mae creu marchnad unedig dan reolaeth, a dwi'n defnyddio'r geiriau yn ar y deg ac yn ofalus, o fewn yr Undeb Ewropeaidd ar gyfer ynni, yn un o'r materion pwysicaf sydd yn ymwynebu ni ar hyn o bryd. Y mae o'n fodd o greu safonau ar gyfer ymateb i newid hinsawdd ar lefel cyfandir cyfan a mwy o fewn y fframwaith rhyngwladol. Ond hefyd y mae gen i ddiddordeb a phrofiad o ymwneud uniongyrchol ar Undeb Ewropeaidd ar ran cynulliad cenedlaethol Cymru. A dyma'r ail bwynt rwy am wneud y prawn yma, sef mae rhaid, dwi'n credu, i'r Lywodraeth y Deyrnas Unedig ac i ymgyrchwyr ar y cwestiwn o berthynas gwledydd Prydain a'r Deyrnas Unedig a'r gweddill o Ewrop sydd o fewn yr Undeb Ewropeaidd, a dwi'n defnyddio'r geiriau yna yn ofalus. Sylweddoli pa mor integredig yw cyfansoddiadau yr Alban Cymru a Gogledd Iwerddon gyda gweddill yr Undeb Ewropeaidd. Mae cyfansoddiad Cymru yn ein deddfau sydd yn gosod datganoli ger bron yn golygu yn bod ni yn gorfod cymhwyso'n hynna i bob amser i ddeddfwriaeth y ddwy sefydliad yr ydym ni'n rhan ohonyn nhw, sef y Deyrnas Unedig yn amlwg, ond yn gynnyddol yr Undeb Ewropeaidd. Ond hyd yn oed yn bwysicach na'r fframwaith derfwriaethol ydy y trafodaethau am bolisi. Dwi wedi cael y fraint o gynrychioli pysgotwyr Penllyn ac Ynys Enlli yn y Senedd Ewropeaidd ac yn y trafodaethau efo'r Comisiwn. A dwi'n edrych ymlaen am gael gwneud hynny eto. Oherwydd mae nhw'n gwybod bod be mae nhw'n gwneud yn môr Iwerddon ac yn y cysylltiadau ar y môr Celtaidd yn dibynnu'n llwyr a beth sy'n digwydd yn Iwerddon ac yn yr Alban ac yn Llydaw ac wrth gwrs yn gwlad y Basg. Y lle mae pysgotwyr getaria bob amser yn barod i fynd i bysgota'n unman yn y moroedd Ewropeaidd os gan nhw'n gyfleinu ni. A dwi'n abod rhai ni hefyd oherwydd fy nysylltiadau gwleidyddol a Llywodraeth Euskadi a wrth gwrs Llywodraeth Catalonia sydd mewn dipyn bach o drafferth byrdymor y dyddiau hyn. Wel rwan ta, mae'n rhaid i ni sylweddoli bod y perthnasau yma yn mynd i barhau. A dwi'n meddwl mae'r celwydd mwyaf sydd yn cael ei bedlera yn ystod yr ymgyrch hon, ydy bod hwn yn rhyw fath o berthynas sydd yma'n cael ei setlo unwaith ac am byth rhwng Cymru, gweddill y Deyrnas Unedig a'r Undeb Ewropeaidd a'r gweddill Ewrop. Nid oes setliad yn bosib yn y datganoli neu'r canoli hwn fwy nag sy'n bosib yn y berthynas o fewn cenhedloedd Prydain. Yn yr ystyr yna, ydw i'n edrych ar y cwestiwn yma, un gair ola. Dwi'n siarad Cymraeg yn y cyfarfod yma oherwydd mae'r Gymraeg yn iaith swyddogol. I lawr lle dwi'n gweithio, drwy ddeddf, mae'r Gymraeg a'r Saesneg yn gyfartal. Yr unig le arall yn Ewrop y mae'r Gymraeg yn gyfartal ar Saesneg, lled gyfartal, lled swyddogol, ond o leia mae yna gyfartaledd, ydy sefydliadau'r Undeb Ewropeaidd. Mae'r Gymraeg wedi cael ei siarad yng Nghyngor y Gweinidogion, wedi cael ei siarad yn y Senedd Ewropeaidd, wedi cael ei siarad yn y Pwyllgor Economaidd a Chymdeithasol, a fe ddim parhau i gael ei siarad. Oherwydd Mr Sean Edwards, dwi'n mynd fod i enwi fo, sy'n yn gyfieithu fi yma heddiw, y mae o'n gyfieithu'r achrededig i'r Undeb Ewropeaidd. Oherwydd er nad yw Llywodraeth San Steffan yn cydnabod y Gymraeg yn swyddogol, y mae sefydliadau i'r Undeb Ewropeaidd yn. Diolch yn fawr i chi am rando ar y bregas yna.
Thank you very much, David. And now on to Stuart Owadali to tell us a little bit about the perspective of Wales Stronger in Europe.
So use this one?
Go ahead.
This one. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Good. Thanks about me. It's a privilege to follow David Ella for that sort of speech as well. And it's good to have Plaid Cymru here. The campaign we've started in Wales has got cross-party support. While we're talking about a people's case of Europe, I think it's good that we've got perspectives from different parties. The Liberal Democrats have their conference today, presumably well, there's no one here from there, and we've had support from Conservatives in Wales as well. The two questions we were asked to respond to: what does the people's case for Europe look like, and what impact would Leaving have on the lives of low and middle income families? The people's case, I mean, there are many ways in which being in Europe is good for families across Britain. Nia mentioned some of the workers' rights, the ease and cost of travel into Europe. Is another thing, the ease with which we share knowledge and expertise throughout Europe as well. But I want to focus on two things in particular, which are jobs and security. In Wales, almost 200,000 jobs are directly linked to our trade in the European Union. That's according to the CEB, 200,000 jobs. That's one in seven of every jobs in Wales, which is directly linked to our trade with the European Union. 95,000 of those in manufacturing, 7,000 in agriculture, 10,000 in accommodation and food services. Our access to the single market is absolutely crucial for the trade that sustains those jobs. And on top of that, CEBR has said that 800,000 more jobs are going to be created over the next 15 years across the UK with our continued membership. The case on that front just couldn't be more clear. Being in Europe now means more job security. And staying in Europe would mean more job prospects for the future for people in Wales. Leaving risks that. There's no other way of putting it. The second thing is on security. My first one on security is that our cooperation with our partners across Europe is absolutely essential to fighting terrorism. We share information which enables us to thwart would-be terrorist attacks across the continent. If we left, it would make that more difficult. Then there's the European arrest warrant. It's crucial across the UK, but in Wales, 101 people have been sent from Wales back into Europe so they can face justice there. 17 people brought back to Wales to face justice here from Europe. If we weren't in Europe, we would just have no access to the European arrest warrant. Those people would potentially still be at large, would be putting people's safety at risk, and would be putting middle and low income families' safety at risk as well. Which brings me to the second question, which is what impact leaving would have on Wales and low and middle income families here. As I mentioned, simply jobs would be put at risk, job security would be put at risk, people's safety would be put at risk, people's finances put at risk because prices would inevitably rise if we were to leave the single market. None of this is actually up for debate. You know, the Leave campaigners themselves admit freely to this. Tim Montgomery, who's a well-known commentator who supports leaving, said, "If we leave, there's risk." Aaron Banks, who runs the Leave.eu campaign, said, "There'll be penalties for leaving, there'll be pain." And Dominic Cummins, who runs the Vote Leave campaign, it's confusing, I know, but there's quite a few different Leave campaigns. he said, "There will be problems, yes," when he was asked if there'll be job losses. It's effectively the only thing that the Leave campaigns can agree on at the moment, is that there will be serious risk, there will be pain if we were to leave the European Union. So for me, the people's case is, for staying in Europe is absolutely clear. More jobs, more job security, more safer families, and a stronger future where we've got Wales and Britain playing a leading role in the development of the European Union.
Thanks. Thank you very much. So we've got plenty of time for some questions and contributions. So I'm very keen to take questions. I'm also happy to take comments, but they need to be question length comments. I don't want speeches. So who would like to speak first? Yes, that is Jenny, isn't it? We have some roving mics, so you, yes, there we go.
Um,
Jenny Rathbone, the Deputy Manager for Cardiff Central. Welcome to our constituency. Thank you to all the speakers. You all made very important points. I'd just like to thank Kelvin for making the journey here, but also to challenge you on what we would do if we weren't in Europe. Because David L made a very clear case as to why we need to be in Europe in relation to our obligations on climate change. I do not understand how, if we left Europe, we would ever get companies to adhere to the all the challenges that we absolutely have to get everybody to adhere to. Equally, fishing, the fish don't respect frontiers. We absolutely have to have a European-wide agreement, not one of our most successful policies of Europe-wide, but we absolutely have to agree with our European partners on how to conserve the fish as a resource for future generations. So I just wondered if you'd like to have that.
Thank you. And another contribution, please. I did see another. Yes, at the back.
Benjamin Swallow. I'd just like to pick up on the sort of the point that's been made, specifically by the new campaign about sort of democracy, for example. And I just sort of find it curious that the focus seems to be on sort of the lack of democracy and transparency in the EU, and why I never really seem to hear any voices about making the EU more democratic and more transparent and more about simply just throwing our hands up in despair and leaving.
Great, thank you. And we'll take one more contribution before we return. Yes, please, just coming to you with a mic.
Hi, my name is Faisal, I'm a student at Cardiff University. Near picked up on the fact we have to think about how we frame the discussion. I think unfortunately in this country the discussion is kind of framed through cultural lens. Europe kind of imposing something on an unruly, unwilling person. So this is more about how we should feel about the European. So I just wanted to ask, how should we feel about it? Because a lot of decisions aren't made on the economic argument. Voters thinking about these kinds of things.
That's great, yes. First mention of sort of the emotional, cultural dimension of this debate. Kelvin, a particular question was asked to you about from Jenny about fishing and climate change, if you want to take those.
Well, yes. I mean, I just don't set the point. I think on climate change, I think certainly under the last Labour government, we were leading the climate change argument. And when we get another Labour government, which I think will be soon, so I think very soon there's going to be a tremendous turn of politics, and I really do believe that Jeremy's going to be our next Prime Minister. We are going to be more committed than the rest of the European Union to deal with climate change. In terms of companies, we've already seen from Toyota, Unilever, Vauxhall, the Society of Motor Manufacturers, they're all said they're going to stay neutral about it. They're going to carry on investing in Britain, whatever, and they're not bothered one way or the other about whether we stay in the European Union. And indeed, I think manufacturing will benefit massively from coming out because we will then be able to use, as I said in my speech, state aids where we need to. We can use public procurement programs to make sure British industry does well. Our manufacturing sector is now half the size of that of Germany as a proportion of GDP. We've allowed our manufacturing to diminish to such an extent. We have a massive trade deficit of £60 billion a year with the rest of the European Union because our manufacturing sector is not big enough to provide all the things we need. We've got to rebuild manufacturing. We can't do that inside the European Union. When it comes to agreements on all sorts of things, we can just do those anyway. We can do that as on a voluntary basis. We have had international agreements, cooperation on policy and whatever, and we can carry on doing that. I personally think we will be very better off straight away by not having to pay in £18 billion a year, which is equivalent to £300 per person per year. So a family of four, £1,200 a year, just that amount. That will be going into our economy and not being spent overseas. I think that will make a tremendous difference.
Thank you. David, can I ask you, particularly maybe about how we should feel about Europe? And, you know, that sense, the question said that Europe's something done to us rather than being part of it.
Well, I have great difficulty. I have an additional professional practice of answering questions in the language in which they're asked, provided I can speak, understand the language. I will respond to you directly. Because I'm one of these congenital bilingual persons, I never knew a time when people ask me, is Welsh your first language? Yes. When did you learn English? Same time. it's so difficult. And that is one of the issues, actually. Let me tell you, English monoculturalism and monolingualism is one of the biggest issues we face. And not just that, it's the residual nation-statism. I detest all nationalism. Big F. I have to live with a lowercase m one because I'm a member of part of the party which has that problem. But it's not my problem, right? As you probably gathered, I'm a European federalist. And I voted the wrong way in 1975 because I agreed with my comrade on the far right from me here. And it was nice to hear that analysis still being said. I'm glad it's still being argued. But I learnt, and I learnt in 1975, the first time after we joined when I was a Member of Parliament in Westminster, of going to visit, not Europe, I was visiting the European Union. And let's stop speaking like that. We keep using this language, which gives away half the argument. I hear the BBC constantly saying, this is about being in Europe, out of Europe. That is, we are all in Europe geographically. These are Absolutely. The West European islands.
Absolutely.
And all that, you know, we could go through all these things.
All right.
We understand where we come from. But when I went to meet the Irish particularly, were there as officials and as politicians, and they were laughing at me. Because they said, what do you think you're doing? Objecting to be part of the greater Europe from the point of view of a small nation. And I swallowed that whole. And then my whole period as chair of the Welsh Language Board, I spent a lot of time, as much as I could clearly, in Catalonia and the Basque Country, not just for the food, the language policies, but also for the infusion of an understanding of the multiness of all that we do. And this is such a huge problem, and I don't know how we deal with it. Because cultural change, I know, because I'm a disciple of Raymond Williams, as those of you who know me know too well, and I know what he'd be saying if he'd be here today. Cultural change takes a long time, and the cultural change we've been going through since we established devolution, having failed in 79 and gone on, it's part of putting Wales in at the heart of at the heart of Europe, but at the heart of European legislative regions and governmental regions. And that's where Welsh Government sits, and that's where National Assembly for Wales sits, and I was part of that when I was presiding officer, and I didn't spend as much time as I would have liked to have spent on the European project. We are there in the Committee of Regions, we are there in the Council of Ministers, part of the UK delegation, and this is where we should be, and this is what we have to develop, and I don't see how there is any other way to go. Because if we go back to mothership and back to the Victorian, this is an Edwardian building, sorry, but the ascendancy of Cardiff as the great imperial coal exporting port, there is nothing there for us. And I can't see why people would ever imagine that. And what excites me most about feelings about Europe is when you get the illogical objection to greater relationship with the European Union from people whose economic interest is clearly to be there. And I'm talking obviously about some farming friends who may be supporters of other parties who insist that there is such a thing as agricultural subsidies coming from a UK government that will match what we have in the CAP. Whatever is wrong with the CAP and the CFP, and I can talk all day about that, it's where we have to be. We will never sell Welsh lamb if we depend on the English to sell it for us, because they'll sell their own bloody lamb. Did I say that?
We heard you loud and clear. let me turn to Stuart. I'd like you to address this sort of head and heart question, the sort of emotional side of the debate, but also the point about the flawed democracy that we have in Europe, and that sense, you know, should we make it better or should we get out?
I think the point that Ben made is absolutely right. I mean, we need to. It's obviously an imperfect institution. No one, I think, any part of this debate is denying that. But in order to change it, you need to be inside it. It's palpably untrue what the Leave campaign say, that we have no influence over Europe and that we're some sort of partner that gets everything done to us. The Prime Minister's just come back and had a deal put on the table for things that, to be fair, not many people thought he would get. We had to be there around the table in order for him to secure those things. So my point on the democracy is that you can only continue to reform the European Union by being inside it. Just to touch on the point that Kelvin made actually about in response to Jenny's question as well. I mean, we're not going to solve problems of climate change unless we cooperate with partners across Europe. It's simple as that, and leaving would put that cooperation at risk. But on the point about manufacturing, I mean, it's absolutely right. We have to try and regrow our manufacturing base here. But with 95,000 manufacturing jobs linked to trade with the EU, that's not some sort of indirect thing. That is directly linked to our membership and our trade with Europe. I don't understand how leaving would help us to rebuild that manufacturing base.
Thank you. Leah.
Okay. Well, I'd like to pick up on a couple of points. Just on the issue of state aid, Kelvin, I think it has to be said that really what happened, if we're talking about the steel industry, was that we had a carbon tax imposed by George Osborne. Then, having imposed a tax which only the UK had, not the rest of the EU, he suddenly had to find a way to mitigate it for the heavy industry. So then has to seek state aid. Well, if we never had the tax in the first place, we wouldn't be seeking it. And, you know, it has been granted. It could have been granted 3 years sooner if he'd gone there 3 years sooner. He didn't get there till 2013, after 2010 was when he was first sort of told about it. So I don't think that is a real argument. I also think on procurement, all the other EU countries seem to manage quite happily to basically put in social clauses which say that for social benefit of the local area, you know, you can have X amount of points. Well, we can do that equally well here. And apparently we do have a piece of paper from government which is sort of setting this out, a new procurement policy. It just hasn't been used for any of the contracts yet. And Germany is in the EU, so the fact they're doing very well is not an argument for us to leave. I think it's an argument for us to be, should we say, a little more flexible about the rules, as perhaps they are in some other EU countries. No, I mean, seriously, there are ways of you know, playing to your advantage within the EU, and so I don't think those are good reasons for leaving. I think we've got a major problem on the emotional thing. If you go to places like Spain and Portugal, and to a certain degree Italy, even though they were actually a founder state, the whole point for them about being in the EU, it's tied in fundamentally to being a democratic state. For them, you know, for Spain and Portugal, they couldn't come in until they were democracies. As I say, there's still the same feeling in Italy. You know, you could go back to fascism if you weren't part of an EU which says you cannot be a member unless you're a democratic state. So they've got a huge emotional thing about being part of the EU, and I don't think there's any way we can really create that in the UK. I don't think we have that same feeling that it's more important to be in the EU than out of it. And that's a very difficult one for us.
Thank you. Let's go to another round of questions and comments. Who would like to go? Yes, first of all there.
I'm Catherine Fuchs, the Labour AM candidate for Monmouth constituency, and unsurprisingly I'm going to talk about farmers, and this is a question I guess for Kelvin. I mean, we've got a lot of farmers in the Monmouth constituency, and they do rely on subsidies, and there is absolutely no way, I believe, that the UK government would pay the same level of subsidies to farmers that we get now. The Welsh farmers I know in my region are waiting for their subsidy. They need that. I think there are areas that we need to reform the CAP, and I'd like to see it greener. But we can only do that if we're in the EU. So I think we need to stay in it. I'm also a member of the Food and Drink in Wales Industry Board, which is trying to grow sales of food and drink in Wales by 2020, and I think we all know, we just need to get the message out there that for procurement, we do, for food, certainly you are able to put in contracts that you use local food. You can't actually say it like that, but you can do, as Nia suggested, putting in the social benefits of choosing a certain type of food. So I'm most definitely for staying in the European Union, and I think most of the farmers in certainly my constituency would agree with that.
Thank you. And there's another hand. Yes, you, sir.
Ricardo Calil from Cardiff University. Quoting something that Winston Churchill said in 1953, regarding Europe, he said in a speech to Parliament, we are with them, we are not of them. And there seems to be an undercurrent of Europhobia in the UK, which has gone through generations since that time. I mean, as a foreigner, I can see, you know, I've been observing this, and as I can see how negative the coverage from the media is, the language from the from politicians is, and how do you change that? Because at the end of the day, a referendum is going to be decided largely on emotional issues like migration, rather than on how much money do we get out of the European Union. So my question is, how do you address this undercurrent of Euro-American skepticism in such a short time?
Thank you. And another contribution? No, I will go back to the panel if no one wants to. Right, well, I'll give you a few minutes to think of another question in the meantime. Can I ask first Stuart and then Kelvin as sort of the different representatives of different campaigning interests? Stuart first, this point about phobia, and you're tackling something that is incredibly deep and visceral. You know, how is your campaign going to do that?
I agree with the point as well, and I think it is difficult to challenge. One of the things we're doing this weekend, starting today, going through into the end of Sunday, is we're campaigning on the streets in Cardiff, in Bangor, in Carmarthen as well, and through the press about the ease and the cheapness of travel into Europe. There's thousands of fans travelling from Wales into Ireland this weekend to watch the rugby. There'll be thousands of Irish and Italian fans coming over over the course of the next 2 months to watch the rugby here. The sort of unifying spirit that the Six Nations brings is something that we want to encapsulate as part of this campaign, because everybody who follows rugby here knows that the Six Nations simply wouldn't work without the fans coming over here and our fans going over there, and the spirit that creates. And that's one of the things we can do to show that there's positive cultural links between people across borders. And I think just to touch on Catherine's question briefly as well, I mean, I absolutely agree with what you said. The Farmers Union of Wales have come out publicly to support staying in. The NFU in Scotland have come out publicly to support it, and the NFU in England and Wales have released some information which clearly shows that the impact on farming, on agriculture, on food would be absolutely, it would be unthinkable really. The jobs that are linked to that as well as the trade, like I mentioned, 7,000 jobs in agriculture, which all of those would be a threat if we left. It couldn't be clearer for agriculture, for food, that it's better off, that we're better off in.
Thank you. Kelvin, you have some uncomfortable bedfellows, don't you? I mean, there are some people on the Leave side who are clearly highly hostile to European institutions and nationalist. That's not your politics.
No, I'm a person of the left, and I make this very clear, and I'm campaigning essentially on Labour platforms, socialist platforms, trade union platforms, and I must say I'm very surprised at people on the right being anti-EU, because they are the free marketeers, the globalisers, the neoliberals, and that's what the EU is about. So I'm very surprised that they're actually, and if you find Euroscepticism in many other countries, it's actually a problem of the left rather than the right, and it's big business and the corporate world that supports the EU. And so I was very surprised that some of the Tories are supporting the Leave campaign. Can I just touch on some of the points that we've made, because I do disagree actually. The farmers, our net contribution is 18 billion, so we can keep all the subsidies exactly as they are and still benefit by 18 billion, and indeed we could subsidise more. And
that I've is said, a contested fact.
Well, I've argued in the House of Commons that I would personally want to support Welsh hill farmers, use that term, because, you know, it's very important to sustain communities. The French do it, subsidising agriculture, fine. And I think agriculture should be sustained for strategic reasons. Before the Second World War, if we left it to the free market, we wouldn't grow any of our food, and we'd be in a terrible situation. So I think for strategic reasons, we have to continue to subsidise agriculture appropriately, but we could adjust those subsidies to our own economy. And for example, I think milk producers are being treated extremely badly at the moment, for supermarkets screwing down prices, which is very hard on them. And I would actually say, well, let's have a milk marketing board again. Let's have a sustained price for milk, that so that the farmers can actually make a profit. I'm happy with that. I'm a socialist. I want to intervene in the market all the time. I don't want to see the free market ruining people. My arguments about Europe, the European Union, and indeed about Europe, are about democracy and economics. I've said before, I passionately love Europe. I love J.S. Bach. I love French wine. I go on a holiday to Umbria. I try to speak European languages. I'm a Europhile in the genuine sense. I love Europe, but I think the European Union is a mistake for people on the continent of Europe as well as here. I want to see a looser association of democratically governed countries working together on a voluntary basis. When it comes to manufacturing, the important thing, and people mentioned Germany, is the euro. The euro is causing terrible damage, not just to southern Europe, but to other people as well. The euro is effectively the Deutschmark with other currencies bolted onto it. And because those other currencies effectively are weak, they hold down the value of the euro, which gives Germany a competitive advantage on manufacturing, which they exploit. And they've done very well by holding down the value of their currency over decades. They were allowed to do it after the Second World War because West Germany had to be the showcase for capitalism against communism. And so they were allowed to, and understandably, they were allowed to have a free run, and they held down their currency value for a long time. I challenged people on this 30 years ago, and in fact I was shouted down by somebody from the Anglo-German Foundation. Don't talk about the euro, don't talk about the Deutschmark, don't talk about currencies. Well, currencies are very important. Every country should be able to adjust its currency value to its own needs. If all those countries in Southern Europe could recreate their own national currencies, most of them would depreciate very substantially and start to recover, Greece in particular. And you saw what happened. The country which pegged its currency to the euro was Switzerland. And about a year ago, they broke the link, and over a weekend, they appreciated by 30% because they were being falsely held down by their peg to the euro. So the euro is a distorting effect on our economy and damaging both of us.
Kevin, we're not in the euro. Haven't we got the best of both worlds by being in the outer orbit of a functioning European Union?
We trade with Germany, and Germany is our 50% of our deficit is with Germany. And because the Deutschmark is effectively is held down, they have an unfair competitive advantage. We import four times more cars from Germany than we export to it, despite the fact that our car industry is doing very well. But we want to have a level playing field with an appropriate value for the German currency as well as our own. That won't happen while the euro is still in place.
Yeah. Do you want to address we talked about farming a little already, but if you want to say more on that, and I'm still interested in this phobia point, but I'm also interested in your thoughts on, Kelvin's countercase. Kelvin's been criticising the status quo, but we haven't heard much about the alternative.
I think a couple of things to say. I mean, the farming issue, obviously, it's like every other sort of institution. It isn't perfect. I don't like seeing rich grain farmers clawing in millions, and members of the royal family and goodness knows what, clawing in all sorts of millions. But we can do reform, and we certainly couldn't have hill farmers here without the subsidies. I think it's absolutely essential that all the harder to farm areas, the upland areas, the small family farms, the smaller units and so forth, it's part of the fabric of our country, a very, very important part of it. So we certainly do need that, and I certainly don't see we'd get it if we weren't part of the European Union. I can't see London being anything like as generous. On the issue of democracy, it's very difficult because all institutions lack transparency. It's often difficult for people to see from the outside how is it that they work, how is it the decisions are made. We have to be clear in the European Union, it is actually the Council of Ministers that has a lot of power, and that is the minister from each of the countries in that particular area, whether it's to do with you know, the economy, or whether it's to do with agriculture or whatever, who come together. So there is input from every single country. There is input. There is input by somebody who's part of an elected government, as well, of course, as having the European Parliament itself. So there are ways of raising things. There are ways of changing things. I think TTIP's a very good example that, you know, people realise there were some problems, and so therefore, you know, members of the European Parliament did call for a halt, and the Commissioner did say, well, let's have a look at things, let's have a stop, let's, you know, have a think about what this is all about. Perhaps it does raise more issues than we've been aware of. So it is an example of how democracy can actually, you know, work and start questioning things.
And Daffy, can I ask you again about this nationalism point? You said, you know, you hate nation statism, but your opponents in this argument are going to use that phobia of all things European.
Yeah, I think I've said too much already, I see on Twitter, so I shall be disciplined once again. Well, nation statism, and which is the correct term, behind that is the ideological nationalism, the belief that humankind were made by the Creator God to be part of nations. And any of us who know anything about the history of religion and the history of culture know that that was never the case. And therefore, the European Union, for me, has struggled to develop itself beyond that culture. I was always an advocate, as you can imagine, of what used to be called Europe of the Regions in the 80s. But that is no longer something that people, it depends how you define that. But the constitutionally, it makes sense because all the issues that Cameron has identified as needing a red card, certainly for us in Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland, it's our red card, or green card, or whatever, or orange card, or whatever card you want to choose, because they are issues which are already part of our legislative program. And trying to answer the longer term question, what we heard from Cardiff University. About the perception of of a long-standing Europhobia is something which has distressed me all my life. But I also recognize that there was once a long-standing affiliation to empire. And I think the one has translated or transmuted itself into the other. And maybe if we can somehow get through that, and I find the whole UKIP as an ideological construct, I find fascinating. And its role in Wales, apparently, in the next few months is going to be fascinating. And I look forward to that. Because I won't use the expression on a Saturday afternoon that I would normally, but have them inside the tent, not outside the tent, so to speak. And that will happen before the referendum. But the point I would want to emphasize is the referendum is not a generational decision. These issues will not go away. The relationships we have established with other regions in Europe and with markets in Europe will not disappear. And I want to say something about lamb, because as my friends know, I'm a Welsh lamb junkie. I have to have, but the small hill lamb. The reason why Welsh hill farmers need to be there is because they produce the best lamb in the world, arguably outside New Zealand. But that's arguably. Certainly in the Northern Hemisphere, we have the best lamb. And one day, the Northern Hemisphere lamb will beat the Southern Hemisphere lamb.
Let's have one round of questions just before we wrap the session. So a couple of hands, three hands, perfect. Let's go for the woman there and then the other two on the row behind. I've got a mic coming, yes.
Hi, thanks.
So
I'm Jenny.
That's
my first baby. So it's very good.
Welcome.
My question is directed at Kelvin, really. There's many points of contention I have with your arguments, but mainly the idea that the left should be Eurosceptic in this country because it's Eurosceptic in Greece and other nation states that have seen EU-imposed austerity. Many kind of polls and statistics have shown that on average, in Greece, support for the single currency is actually higher than the EU average. Even Switzerland recognises that being part of Europe is more productive for their economy and the people than leaving. And instead, we've got a more engaged Eurocritical debate in Greece rather than Eurosceptic, which is the way of framing it. And I think it's healthy to be Eurocritical when nobody's saying the EU is perfect. So I just wondered what you thought about that.
Thank you. If you could pass the mic behind you to. Yeah.
You said it would be better if I was.
Could you say who you are as well?
Thanks.
Fine.
You said it would be better if Europe had a. Or Europe, I don't mean EU, Europe, the geographical space was just a kind of voluntary organization, voluntary relationship between democratic countries. I mean, that's what it is. To suggest it isn't that Europe hasn't invaded any of its. The EU hasn't invaded any member states or anything like that. They've all enthusiastically actually took part. Europe is a momentous political project, as well as an attempt to integrate some of the largest economies in the world into one huge market. But I think false polarization is a discussion between an in and out rather than an in, and I want this as well, is unhelpful. Don't you think it would be better to reform Europe so there was a more social Europe rather than just save up and put out and then live with the consequences afterwards?
Thank you. And then the final question in this session. Yeah.
Neil Evans from the Rhondda. The question directed to David as a member of our National Assembly. And we're obviously very passionate about Wales and the Welsh language and how the EU allows that to flourish. Do you think it's fair that Wales be dragged out of the EU by the English war? And have the National Assembly started bringing the plans in place in case the worst thing should happen?
It's a good question to end on. Right, so there were two sort of questions directed particularly at Kelvin and Dafydd, but I'm going to ask all four of our panellists just to sort of reflect on any of those points, but also to make a short sort of 1 minute or so closing statement for this session. Let me start with Dafydd. Would you like to go?
We haven't made final plans yet, but discussions are going ahead. And the interesting thing is, if you look at all of those we've had, on the affiliation to the EU in the Assembly. The overwhelming majority, I won't finger any individual Conservatives that didn't vote, have been with us in terms of the project. And you might like to look as well what we are now doing to shaft the UK government and the Secretary of State on his appalling so-called Wales Bill, where we all voted together. And I'm sure, I am absolutely sure, and I won't look to any of, well, one of my colleagues, what she would say, but I'm sure that we will not want our relationship with the European regions within CALRE, the Standing Conference of European Legislative Assemblies, nor the Welsh Government's relationship with the European regions to be disrupted by anything that Westminster can do. And the other serious constitutional part of it is how do you unpick the European law, the UK law, and the Welsh law from the way that our institution is developing? Because the whole thing about devolution is the obverse, is the other side of the coin of globalism. And this is what we are doing. We are developing an institute, a democratic institution, within our particular legislative region, which matches what other people are doing. And of course there will be discussions from time to time about people coming out or people going further, but that's the nature of politics. But I think if we can establish a positive idea of federalism at all levels, which is, you know, I attacked big N nationalism earlier, but I'm a big F federalist. And I would like to say big F to some of the people. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that.
Dafydd, thank you very much. Stuart, final thoughts from you.
Yeah. I agree with what Faisal said, but just to add to that, Kelvin raised an example of Europe and Britain before the Second World War really on. Before the Second World War, Europe was almost constantly at war. Since then, European Union has been a driving force for peace. They gave the European Union the Nobel Peace Prize for that exact reason. To talk about Europe and Britain before the Second World War in this context, I mean, it's very clear what the benefits of being in the European Union since that time period. on Neil's point, I mean, I'm not concerned. I'm confident that we'll win this referendum, but it's going to take a lot of work. And we need to get out, we need to start campaigning and continue to get the message out. I mean, I've touched on the main things before. 200,000 jobs here in Wales are linked to our membership of the European Union. That is, when we're talking about the people's case, that is the fundamental thing that people want to know. What is the impact that this is going to have on people's jobs and on their security? And for that, the case is absolutely clear. We're stronger, we're safer, and we're much better off as part of Europe. But then the people's case can only be made by the people here as well. So I would encourage you, if you are keen to help us win this referendum, to get involved with this campaign. We're on the ground, and there's leaflets at the back you can sign up with, you can speak to me afterwards, but please do take part in this. It's the only way we're going to win, is by speaking to as many people as we possibly can.
Stuart, thank you very much. Kelvin?
Yeah, a lot to answer, but I'll be as quick as I can. Greece and left Euroscepticism? Well, understandably, I've spoken to a left journalist from Greece who supports Syriza, and he agreed with me that the fear that the Greeks have is being disengaged or somehow separating from Europe. They see themselves as Europeans, and understandably so. They're in a very dangerous part of the world, and they for several centuries they were dominated by Turkey, effectively. They were part of the Turkish Empire. And they are terrified that that might happen again. And he says, this is why we hang on to the euro, even though we know it's economically damaging for us. I would say, you know, you're of course European, and we would always support Greece and its independence and its democracy. EU laws, we are constrained by EU laws, but just state aid is one of the things. Social Europe, the Laval and Viking Line cases showed that when it comes to the crunch, the European Court of Justice will find in favour of employers against trade unions, and despite the fact that the trade unions fought very hard, they lost. Trade union rights have been marginalised in countries where they've got bailouts on condition that the government's put a break on collective bargaining. And they've just begun a general strike in Greece about the cuts, savage cuts in pensions. This thing about war and peace, actually, I think it's a non sequitur. We haven't had a war because we know, you know, whatever the reasons, you know, we get on well. What's been happening recently is actually there is some tensions. Many Greeks now blame Germany for their position. There's been criticisms of Germany from Spain and Portugal on the left as well. Their tensions are rising between countries in Europe as a result of the European Union. And if we were allowed to have our own currencies and adjust and work on a voluntary collective basis, I think that these things will be easier. But my final oration, if you like, is that the European Union is for handing power to the market, to the corporations, to neoliberal capitalism, which drives inequality, low and negative economic growth, and economic instability. It's not in the interest of working class people. We are facing another major economic crisis because of the freedom to move money across boundaries and without controls at national level for our economies. Another crisis is coming, and when that crisis happens, I think it will cause terrible damage to the EU, and countries will be forced by their peoples to act on the interests of their peoples, and we will see a very different kind of world, sadly. And this is not me speaking, this Crispin Odey, who's a hedge fund manager, a big multimillionaire, saying this is coming. It's been going to be a crisis that will be remembered for 100 years. This is, you know, sounds like doom-laden words, and they are, and it is very frightening. But we had a terrible crisis in 2008, which we survived because governments recapitalised banks. They won't be doing that again. But if we do have another crisis soon, I think the European Union will change very strong, very dramatically indeed. And I like to think that working people will then re-establish democratic control of their lives, which they will not have through the European Union.
Thank you, Kelvin. And Nir, to finish this session, is there a people's case for Europe?
Well, very much so. And I think Jenny hit the nail on the head when she talked about Eurocritical, that we don't simply accept things as they are, but we say that this is a good framework to work within, and we can work within this framework. I think on the issue of do we have the sort of idealism that characterises the approach from some of the European countries, the answer is we don't have the same sort of rhetoric that perhaps you hear in school gatherings and so forth across Europe. It tends to be here very practical. That's what we have to say to our lower and middle income families, I think. We do have to be absolutely upfront and say, well, okay, it won't be immediately, but over the next few years, certain companies will stop investing here and start investing more elsewhere. Jobs will be disappearing. It's a world that's very uncertain out there. Way, way back, pre-1975, when I was alive and did vote in 1975, we had a different relationship with the rest of the world. We still had remnants of the empire, and much of that market is gone. South Asia has changed remarkably in that time. So we need very much to keep that partnership with our EU partners. We do have the best of both worlds, being in the EU, but not actually in the Euro. The same with the Schengen Agreement. We're part of Europe, but we're not actually inside the Schengen area. So again, we have a little bit more flexibility. So let's use that Eurocritical faculty in a very positive way to make sure that we create a better EU. But let's make sure we're in that EU and at that top table, able to negotiate.
Yeah, thank you very much. Would you join me in thanking all our panellists? Now we're going to do a very quick turnover to start. The session on EU reform is just coming up, so please stay in your seats. We're going to swap the top table, and also could you pass the headsets along to the end of your row, because we won't be using them in the next session.
Fine, I'm just about to look at it, but I've just got up from speaking at the World Conference. So what were you telling me? That you've all gone home since May. Oh, I know. I can really appreciate that. Yeah, I'm sure everybody needs to go home and have some cakes and tea or something. And yes, no, that's absolutely fine. Yeah. Not as soon as possible. And I didn't come out,
This one, right?
Yes.
Alex, right.